Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Such thing as a Superman. There ain't no such thing as a Superman. You was on the Nile. You went to see Great Egypt fall. It fell down to the ground. Yes, and you was out there on the corner. When being cool went blind. Are you alone? Understand that if we're gonna win, we've got to get together, stay together, be together, stick together. So tell me why can't you understand that there ain't no such thing as Superman?
There ain't no context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another segment, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, June 16th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our second study session on the autobiography of Gil Scott Heron, The Last Holiday. We are picking up on chapter 7, the song we heard at the beginning, Ain't No Such Thing as Superman, 1975. I know a lot of folks, at least from people who participated last week, said that they were familiar with a lot of the music that Gil Scott Heron did, as well as he and Brian Jackson throughout the years. We're going to try and include some of his legendary songs, many of them directly addressing racism. So we'll try to make that a part of the narrative as we go. Without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get started. Most of what we heard last week dealt with him reminding us, emphasizing why he's doing this book, the importance of Dr. King getting the federal holiday, his assassination, him growing up and spending time in Tennessee, Memphis specifically, Jackson also, his time in Mississippi as well, and then also his migration to New York. So this week we'll just get more of his childhood observations on race and many other things as a young child, as well as just additional information on how he became such a legendary artist and writer. Without further ado, The Last Holiday, a memoir by Gil Scott Heron. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 1. 7. When St. Francis was condemned, I landed at South Jackson Elementary School. I didn't do a lot of singing there, but every once in a while, my best friend Glover and me would call ourselves doing something that was supposed to be singing. The prettiest girl in our class was named Wanda Womack. She had two sisters, and they were all fine, but Wanda was the one in my class. Somehow, in fifth grade, the word got around school was that Wanda and I were going together, like girlfriend and boyfriend. It seemed as if people looked around and put people together just like that. Richie Valens had just put out the song Donna, and Glover and I were fooling around, and I was switching the words so that it was Oh Wanda instead of Oh Donna. Glover dared me to sing it in class. I said I would if he'd do the background. The crowd went wild. Naturally, we tried another tune right after that. We went into All in the Game, and it was awful. Wanda and I ended up going together for a few years until seventh grade. Though back then, you'd have to stay up all night to be up early enough to know much about sex. I guess we might have kissed once or twice when I walked her home from school. I went on one date with Wanda, if you could even call it a date. There was a banquet held at our church in honor of our basketball team. Usually, we were lucky to finish the season. That year, we finished first. To be honest, Wanda and I were competitors more than girlfriend and boyfriend. There was a stiff competition for grades between the three top girls and the three top boys in our class, and that meant Wanda, Dorothy Nell Bobbitt, and Alice Bonds against me, Glover, and John Odom. I was still a report card Scott in Jackson and was an A student through the sixth grade. Though I did well, I didn't have good study habits. I depended on my memory of the classroom discussions and the notes I would take from the blackboard while the class was going on. But grades were important, and I took pride in getting good grades. I had a lot to live up to. my mother's sister, Gloria, was already teaching English overseas. She'd been in Indonesia and Israel and sent me a camel saddle from Egypt. It was the only one in Jackson. Despite the lack of mementos and photos from those early years, I can reach down into a barrel, it seems, and bring up scraps of yesterday's once tossed aside like gum wrappers. The raw feelings, like shock or sharp pain or fear suddenly grabbing your heart, are closest to the top, easiest to reach. They return to me unbidden at times. I burned the back of my right hand badly on the coal and wood stove that sat like a cast iron Buddha in the living room, my grandmother's bedroom. Another time, I needed a dozen stitches in my left leg from a frantic slide into third base. I played Little League baseball and football and basketball. Shortstop, pitcher, quarterback, pass catcher, guard, imagining I was preparing for Mary Lane High and Lane College. I remember playing nearly all sports except soccer, which we scarcely knew about in Jackson. I can see other disconnected pieces of my childhood life in Jackson. I remember Harry Carey announcing the St. Louis Cardinals games from all the neighborhood radios. I remember going to Sunday services at church as regularly as a deacon. First flashes of what I thought was love, sensations close to shock each time I saw the prettiest girl I had ever seen. The memory frozen like an ice sculpture as I stood with barely a heartbeat. A "don't let her know" grin shattering like a windshield all the "be cool" I was reaching for. Stacks of these images sit neglected in the barrel, fascinating, nearly faded slices of my life. There were things growing everywhere, and a lot of talk about what folks were planting and how various crops were doing. That part of the country is known for its black, fertile soil that was good to grow, and people did some growing. Outside of town, there was cotton by the bale, tobacco by the pound, and strawberries by the quart box plucked from the bushes that grew shin high. But the farmers out in the country, which is what we called everywhere outside of town, weren't the only ones growing. In the front and backyards of the houses in town were displays of the yesterdays, displays that showed these town folks' roots were not too solidly city, that only their houses were planted in town while something within them drove them out to dig and hoe and rake and dirty their hands in the dying sunlight to plant if only a single row of vegetable memories to turn full spades of thick black soil over and slice it with their shovel tips to a depth of 8 inches. They could reach into the pockets of their gardening aprons for seeds to sprinkle among the decapitated worms. In the backyard on South Cumberland Street, my grandmother and I were an unlikely farming duo. There was an annual yield from a peach tree and a grapevine weaving its way along the south fence. Half the backyard space was cleared one fall and flattened near where a basketball backboard was erected with a netless orange rim, but otherwise there was a row of tomatoes, a couple rows of thin spring onions, and an attempt at cabbages one year. In the front yard, there were roses and snowball bushes, and the prize of the yard, a pomegranate bush that grew in season with its branches loaded down by the pale red apple-looking fruit bursting with tiny, juicy buds. It was in the backyard that I first encountered and defeated a snake hoeing an arm's length non-poisonous chicken snake to mince, slashing at the earth with such unaccustomed energy that my grandmother came out to take a look. "I knew you were doing more than weeds," she said, trying to assess the danger and confirming that there was none. "Oh, boy," she chided, "this was harmless." "It is now," I told her, trying to catch my breath. Just knowing that there were several species of poisonous snakes in Tennessee, most notably water moccasins and cottonmouths, put me in no mood to check on pedigree before deciding that the state could do with one fewer. I had a black cat with a small patch of white at its throat. I didn't like most animals. I didn't like dogs showing their attention with wet tongues and cold noses. I did not like fish or birds because there was nothing to pet. I loved cats and still do. But somebody poisoned my cat, and my grandmother didn't want me to see the cat dying under the back porch. That's how I became acquainted with cruelty, and with the fact that death doesn't always just happen, it can be caused. The memory is of me sitting and crying on the back porch with my grandmother holding me by my shoulders, both to comfort me and to keep me from looking beneath the porch where my cat had crawled away to die. I had felt somehow like the prince of the neighborhood who knew everyone and was cared for by all, but evidently not, because I had to be shielded and warned away. Someone had poisoned my cat. Someone killed Snowball. Other images of death follow on from that. Mr. Spann's funeral, when they should have kept the casket closed after he lost control of his car and burned up inside. The services for a little girl of 7 I knew who had a heart attack and died. I hadn't known that death took people that you knew and children so young. And once I knew that, I knew what it meant when I saw an ambulance in front of Aunt Sissy's house, which I could see from the window of my school. She was brought out on a stretcher, and I knew she wouldn't be back. The images of relatives, good friends, and the neighbors who were close enough to be called cousins and uncles and aunts, and even though they weren't kin, are clear. Some of them are animated, moving through the parts of their lives where I saw them most often. Some of the ladies are dressed up and clean like Sunday mornings. The men are covered with the dust and grime of a day's work like a second skin. Most are smiling, enjoying something, but others are bent to nearly broken in half, crying in front of my grandmother, who is lying in a coffin surrounded by flowers. I found Lily one sorry Monday morning in November during 7th grade, cold to my touch. I'd gotten up to make her breakfast, and I knew it was strange that she wasn't stirring. I slipped quietly down the back hall to the kitchen to get the food going and saw her laying there, her profile clear in bed in the shadows of her darkened bedroom. When I dropped a pan, I took another furtive glance, but she still hadn't moved. I went on frying strips of crackling bacon and eggs in the skillet, and as they were sizzling, I took a wash pan of heated water and a washcloth to her room and placed them on the nightstand. I called her name softly and touched her wrist to wake her. She was as cold as ice, and so stiff with rigor mortis that I could barely lift her arm. I called next door, and the kid picked up the phone. I was so wild, he dropped it. I went outside and saw the woman from the house going to work, and she came and took over. At the funeral, Uncle Bobby sat at the end of the pew crying, tears seeping from under his glasses and staining his shirt like sweat. I can feel myself almost falling into this image, beaten up again and nearly blown over, stunned and stomped on, pushing against a gale force wind to close a door I never meant to open. But I remember as I turn away from the images and the barrel that I did not cry. Not that day. I had run out of tears. 8. Up to that day in November 1960, my mother had seemed more like an aunt, just like her sisters, like Sammy was a tomboy aunt and Gloria was a bookworm aunt. But on that dingy gray morning, my mother and I had been brought together like cymbals in some ill-coordinated band's clanging climax. It wasn't only that we were unprepared to be put together then, it was that we had both just lost our mother. Immediately after my grandmother's funeral, I spent 6 weeks in New York with Aunt Sammy and Uncle William. New York City was as cold as a whore's heart that December. Every fucking day. I couldn't ever remember a day in Tennessee as cold as an average day in New York. And there was snow up to your ass, or at least well over the rubber overshoes I wore. At the school I attended for a few weeks, the teachers talked funny, and I hardly knew what was going on because I came in on the offbeat. Since I knew I was going to be leaving again soon, there was no incentive to listen up and catch up. Aunt Sammy, born Sam Ella Scott, had been a hellraiser as a child and was the biggest sports fan in the family. And no wonder, since she had played basketball through high school and college and worked as a physical education teacher. On previous visits to New York, Sammy had taken me to my first live baseball games to see the Dodgers play at Ebbets Field and to Yankee Stadium for a game against the Indians. She had taken me out on her motor scooter, not just around her neighborhood on 225th and White Plains Road in the Bronx, but out to Coney Island and to Yonkers Raceway. Sammy loved to gamble, and when she wasn't on the rail watching trotters, she hosted all-night rent party poker games. William was no shrinking violet either. Though he was an obvious intellect, he had majored in math and graduated early from Lane College. Like his sisters, he had been anxious to leave the rural reality of Jackson behind. Unlike the three ladies, who headed first for Chicago and its booming post-war economy, William signed an agreement with the U.S. Air Force and was stationed in Wiesbaden, Germany, before settling in New York City and taking an upper-level position with the Social Security Administration. I'm not sure where the name William came from, but it didn't matter because everybody called him Baby Brother, which got shortened to BB or just B. I enjoyed hanging around with Sammy. The best thing about being with Aunt Sammy was that she liked to go places that I enjoyed. It was not like spending time with someone who would rather have been anywhere else. And when she talked to me, she looked directly at me, not faking interest. She talked to me as though I had a brain and could understand English. It was refreshing. Often she had to preface whatever we were doing with a conspiratorial, "Don't tell your mama where we went." And I didn't. Back in Jackson, my mother, who moved back from Chicago and I spent the next year on South Cumberland Street together like the first two people at the rail watching the lifeboats lowered as our lives took on water. Even if my mother cared to live in Jackson, where the roots of everything Scott were planted in the yard, and secure her teaching position at Lane College, notices were being served throughout that section of South Jackson. There was a four-lane highway coming through from the south that would connect to Interstate 70, and it would reach us by the end of 1962. Everybody had to go somewhere. My mother and I stayed put and picked up our mail there, but my mother was already firming up plans in touch with her brother, Uncle B, in New York. She and I lived together, and I started eighth grade back at South Jackson Primary School, but something else was happening too. My mother, far more perceptive and far more committed to me than the other way around, was obviously making up her mind about her son. She knew she loved me, because mothers do, but she had to decide whether she liked me. I think she decided we could be friends as long as I was honest. The best way to do that, she decided, was to let me see that she was honest. No hype and no hurry. What she showed me as time passed was that her faith was unshakable and her love unconditional. There was a brand new junior high in town, an all-white public school called Tigrit, for students from the 7th to the 9th grades. There was also a lot of talk about desegregation as Brown versus the Board of Education crept across the South, and school boards started to understand the ramifications of what Brother Thurgood Marshall taught the Supreme Court. In November 1961, a petition circulated through South Jackson Primary School, a list of who's willing to go to a white school or who wants to go to a white school. I signed up. So did a lot of other people. But the crackers down there still felt a certain obligation to the Confederacy, an inherited allegiance to the memory of Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis, even though all they had to relate to were the names of highways and the battlefields that had been turned into tourist traps. I knew the list was just something that had to be done according to the law to demonstrate a need for transfers to be approved. It's possible that some folks only signed up because they thought the NAACP lawyer who was preparing a court case to challenge the segregated school system needed to demonstrate substantial numbers. I don't think anyone thought it would happen anytime soon. One night, just after New Year's Day 1962, when the second half of the school year was just starting, my mother came into my room. When something was serious, my mother would take a pin and twist it through a curl in her hair while her voice got deep and she said things very clearly, loud enough to be heard, but soft enough that you had to listen. A tone of anti-panic, like she could be heard actively being calm. A kind of calmness that made the hairs stand up on the back of your neck. It used to really get on my nerves when I heard that tone of voice. But I was also still getting to know my mother. It had been only a year since my grandmother died, and I didn't know how to interpret her tone of voice and how serious it was. That's how she sounded that night. And it sounded serious. It sounded like I was in trouble, or somebody was. I waited for her to get to the point as she started to explain that the negotiations between the NAACP lawyer and the Jackson City Council had been settled. that is, settled in favor of the NAACP. Then my mother asked whether I still wanted to go to a white school. She never said I was going. She just asked whether I wanted to go. And if I wanted to, I had to start the next day. She said 40 students had signed the petition when it first went around in November, but now that they were ready to integrate the junior high school, there were just 3 making the switch, and that was if I decided to go. I asked her who was going. She said Madeline Walker, who I'd gone to St. Joseph's with, and Glover, who was my man, were the other 2 students. I think part of why her jaw was so tight that night was because she was upset that so many of the other kids had backed out. But she didn't say anything more except that I should think about it, that nobody would look down on me for not going, that in fact, no one would even know anything in particular. All they had ever announced publicly was that there had been 40 names. Did she want me to go? I thought she did, but she also wanted to be fair. She knew when I signed up, there had been a long line in front and behind me, a lot of people. I figured the city council was calling our bluff. Okay, y'all coloreds, let's see how many of these signatures are just autographs. I decided to go to Tigrit and started the next day. I didn't know what to expect. All the books were the same, and the syllabus was the same too. We were in approximately the same place in the syllabus as we'd been at South Jackson. They always said the schools were separate but equal, and the books weren't the difference. The school was very different physically. Tigret was departmental, and we went from classroom to classroom and had different classes with different people. That was new to me. At South Jackson, we stayed in the same class with the same folks all day long. It may sound strange, but I didn't look ahead. If I had, I might have realized we would get to the Civil War in American history. That was going to come up, but I swear it snuck up on me, and the ramifications snuck up on the class. When we did get to the Civil War, it was like reviewing it from the loser's locker room. I don't know how many classes I'd had about the Civil War up to that point, but none of them had ever been from a point of sympathy with the South. Okay, so now the South was the home team. We landed on a page with a picture of a black man in chains, a slave. It was as if nobody knew it was coming. Everyone froze for a minute. Then this one guy, Stevie, who was a real pain in the ass, snickered. The teacher chastised him and took over again, and we moved on. I have come to the conclusion that the spirits played a part in integrating Tigrit, in making it work so smoothly. I found out later that right after New Year's Day, the city council wanted to make a deal. It was a secret that stayed that way until we were already in classes, leaving no chance for opposition to build. If they could integrate the schools quietly without confrontation, they could save money, avoid any bad publicity for the city, keep down the potential for rednecks to stir up trouble if the question had gotten into the news. The council had some specifics when striking the deal with the NAACP lawyer. Only junior high students and Tigrit would be the test school, in part, I'm sure, because of its location far from Main Street. The council also wanted to go immediately with as close to zero noise about it as possible. I suppose they must have sat down and said, "Hey, it's coming, like tomorrow morning and Judgment Day, and color TVs you can afford, and decided to get a jump on things. I don't want to prop up the Jackson City Council as societal visionaries, but their plan worked pretty smoothly, and it was a move that advanced the city's economic potential 1,000-fold. It made clear that Jackson's politicians knew the Civil War was over. 9. By the spring of 1962, as 8th grade at Tigrette finished up, the bulldozers and road graders working on the new highway were just over the rise to the south, only a few miles away. My uncle, Bibi, had organized a 3-bedroom place for us to share with him in the Bronx. My mother and I were moving to New York. The night before we were scheduled to leave Jackson, I went around to see some people one more time. I had known that we were going to New York for months, but we held on to the hope that before we left, something would come up, something that could save me from the big city. I didn't think about what had happened to my grandmother. I didn't consider what my mother wanted or what my uncle had planned. Nobody else's life mattered but mine. I realized what that was. It was terribly selfish. I recognized my feelings for what they were. They were my sight, my hearing, my senses of taste and touch and smell all together. They were my sum total, and I didn't look for this total to give me answers, because somehow no single sense of what was happening to my life could make sense of it all. Only when I asked myself how I felt could I relax as though I knew something. I knew that "how do you feel?" wasn't the right question to ask most people. It was rhetorical, irrelevant, a question as mundane as it was insignificant to most people, but not to me. I could blame it on geography. The move to New York wasn't something that my mother or anyone else was responsible for. We had to move somewhere. If not to New York, then to some other new somewhere. The urban renewal project that had been rumored for so long as part of Jackson's future was literally just over the hill. From Church Street, I could see the bulldozers. For years, it had been vaguely rustling off stage like a coming storm, but now it was starting to ring. Jackson's urban had become renewal. Political concessions made things suddenly doable. A 6-lane highway paved the way with mass approval, and the house on Cumberland Street faced imminent removal. And all my old side streets were asphalt memory lanes, and in July of 1962, I left on a 4 a.m. train. I didn't want to go, but I came to the conclusion that there was no villain, no one who should be the target of my disappointment. I was just one of 1,000 people from South Jackson who had to get the hell out of the way. And I felt better about myself by the time the train reached Chicago, halfway to New York. When we arrived in New York, we moved into the apartment my uncle had found on Hampden Place in the Bronx. Our street was only one block long and just 2 blocks from the 207th Street Bridge just over Fordham Road. It was within walking distance to Uncle B's job at the Social Security office on Jerome Avenue, and only a 15-minute walk from what would be my new junior high, Creston. This new place seemed a long way from the place on 225th and White Plains Road, where I had stayed a year and a half before, after my grandmother's funeral. Both addresses ended in Bronx, New York, but that's all I knew that connected them. My 6 weeks at the other place were not long enough for me to have lost my rookie status. The apartment was different for sure. It was pretty nice. It was on the second floor, which was the top floor, and my room had plenty of room for all my junk and a window that let in a nice breeze. Our things from Jackson had arrived before us, and our black and white TV was in the living room. BB had a color set on a stand in his room, and I was allowed to watch his TV when he wasn't there. That ended up being a couple of nights a week and most weeknights. But I didn't feel comfortable, that's all. I felt stupid and awkward around my uncle and at the store and everywhere else. It was disquieting to move from a place where you knew every blade of grass to a place where there was no grass. And New Yorkers made you feel that you were beneath or beyond their notice. I wondered whether I could or should adjust to that, to try to be like that, or just to try to ignore it. That's what they did, just ignored everything. Living with my uncle was a great benefit for my mother. She had someone she trusted and respected to share the expenses with, and once school started, someone to challenge me on what had become a mediocre academic performance and question the silent hours I spent in my room writing short stories and essays. Beginning the year before, in the eighth grade, I had wanted to write stories, songs, poems, essays, whatever. I read and I wrote. But what I read was not my homework or lessons. And what I wrote was primarily practice for myself. The time I spent on it was non-negotiable. My uncle's position was that there was no excuse for my doing less than excellent work in my classes, getting less than the straight A's all the Scots had worked for and gotten. The fact that I had finished Tigret with no A's was not up to his standards. I remembered my mother reading to me from letters Uncle B wrote us before the move, saying there were lots of kids Scotty's age in the neighborhood, that he saw them all the time. But either they had all moved away in the meantime, or BB had been drinking too much. There didn't seem to be any young people around. After going out every morning and afternoon and not seeing anybody younger than the hill that went up to the dead end at the end of our block, I was miserable. I finally gave myself a break and started looking at the advantages. The main one seemed to be that I was returning to New York at the same time as National League Baseball. The New York team was a collection of old New York players from old New York teams that made the New York team's games like an old-timer's day every day. I became a follower, if not exactly a fanatic, of New York's Metropolitans, who were slickly and quickly transformed, shortened to the Mets, probably for back-page headline convenience. There were 13 letters in the long way to say Mets, and sometimes the whole back-page headline was 13 letters. Something like, Mets lose again, fit perfectly, and often, that first year. They were firmly ensconced in last place by the time I got to the Bronx with no dream of advancing. I gloried in headlines like, Mets win one in a row. Eventually, I also found the kids my age BB had sworn were around. There was a small fry, a kid about 8 years old, who I met one day when I was out throwing my rubber ball against a wall. I asked him if there were other kids around, any guys my age, any kids who could play ball, real games. He said yes, 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 and yes, and explained that games of stickball and softball were played at the Deegan. He was too young to have left the block, though, so he couldn't tell me how to get to the Deegan. He headed home. But the kid, the first New Yorker I met who didn't know at all and admitted it, returned a little while later with a thin white guy in his early 20s known as Jimbo to his friends on Hampton Place. Jimbo knew quite a bit. Within 15 minutes, I had told my mother, gone back out, and walked the 5 minutes it took to reach the Deegan. It really only took the New York kids one quick look. From the time that I got in the game, they can tell right away if you can or cannot play, a player, or just one more lane. After an inning or so, when one kid had to go, I agreed to right field in nothing flat, and I didn't make a play because no balls came my way. I did nothing until I came to bat. And I really don't mind saying I was so glad to be playing, that the moment they threw me the ball, the mix of raw anticipation and my 2 weeks of frustration helped me hit a double off the wall. The smile on my face told the kids from Hampton Place that a player had moved to their street. They could all mock my draw, but they knew I could play ball. It shows how much I need to compete. My Aunt Sammy went with me on my first day at Creston Junior High. I had been thoroughly saturated by then with stories that might best be titled Tales of Creston. Certain actual events with semi-factual incidents, in retrospect, make no damn sense, but at the time seemed real intense. The mythic and the legendary exaggerations seemed so scary. Life feels extremely temporary when you're headed for the mortuary. Well, needless to say, Creston was not fatal. Aside from the fact that it was all male and that Aunt Sammy signed me up for a vocational program that had me taking metal shop and electrical shop. My mother straightened that out, but her motivation to become a presence at my school wasn't because of my lackadaisical absence of enthusiasm for the simple-minded remedial courses I was taking during the first months at Creston. She went to Creston because I never had homework, and she finally saw a report card listing the courses I was in. The day after the first report cards were issued, I was called down to the vice principal's office. There was a murmur of respect for me when the announcement went out during after-lunch homeroom. His office was responsible for discipline. I had been there before. Related to his real job, when something went down at Creston, or if Creston students were suspected of something in the neighborhood, including a 2 or 3 block section of Grand Course, reprimands or an investigation and a suspension might be in order. These punishments were administered by the vice principal. I had seen him after I engaged another ninth grader in a slap fight. This time, he opened with his taking charge voice. "Heron," he said, tossing out a soiled paper plate and hanging up his coat. "Your mother is a very impressive lady." He turned into my surprised expression with a shark's grin and reclaimed his seat behind his desk. I knew now this wasn't about his usual business. He left me standing above him, a position he would never have conceded to an adversary or someone who was about to receive bad news or bad treatment. "She was here this morning," he continued, opening a folder, "and she's got an unusual complaint. She says remedial courses for you are nonsense. you know, that you could have handled remedial before you were enrolled, that the time you spend in the classroom probably feels like detention, and that even in her worst nightmare, she never saw you at a vocational high school. He leaned back and appraised me, as if looking at me for the first time. Perhaps he really was. I looked at him for eye contact. He looked back at the folder. I went to talk to your teachers, you see? Your mother wouldn't have been the first one to suspect that her son was more Einstein than Frankenstein, you know? He liked that one. More seminal than criminal, I muttered, tiring of being played with. He started eyeing me suspiciously. Well, it was damn near unanimous, and they agreed with her. Ha! When I told her I'd looked into it, she said she'd wait. Ha! I don't think she necessarily believed me, so I assured her I'd have a response today that you could give her when you got home. I was really beginning to think she knew what she was talking about. Her dress and bearing and vocabulary. Everything. Anyway, there was a bit of a discussion with Mrs. Kaufman, and she said you'd have to work on your math. I nodded. He stood up, folding the folder on me as he rose. So we're moving you to 9-2. Mrs. Kaufman will be your new homeroom teacher. Mrs. Katz has a note from me, and everybody else will be informed by tomorrow and have their class rosters amended. I nodded again like Uncle Buddy. You can move now. Be sure to give my regards to your mother. He reached for my hand. I also advanced my music career greatly at Creston. Actually, I had no musical ambitions at the time. I liked to sit down at the piano and play the chords to Ooh Baby Baby by Smokey Robinson. But that was about it. Until I got a break. A little red-headed music teacher at Creston summoned me to her classroom one day. When I got there, she asked me to read to her, to read a part of a script. I didn't know it at all, but it turned out to be From the Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan, and she had me read the lead role, Coco, the High Executioner. I found out later the guy, the teacher, had wanted to play the role, had rejected the part, so she had asked around for ideas about other candidates who might have some musical inclinations. There was only one play a year, and from what I understood, the guy had been a smash hit the year before. It was almost taken for granted that he'd star in the Mikado. I guess he was playing hard to get. I ended up getting the lead role as the executioner who doesn't want to execute anyone. Seemed like I was getting typecast. Context of white supremacy. That will conclude our first audio segment. Gil Scott-Heron, The Last Holiday. Folks have commentary they would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I will give out the number if folks want to use the VOPE to dial in. I just want to make sure that I timestamp something that has been mightily stressful. Man, oh man, oh man. Everyone affiliated, past, present, future, with the Department of Motor Vehicles, the Department of Licensing, the Motor Vehicle Division, as it's known in New Mexico, so I have been told, or any other entity associated with giving out licenses. I hope they burn in hell, everybody that is affiliated with all of those organizations, listeners included. Now, and I was actually successful. I forgot to even preface. I was apparently successful at the Department of Licensing because I got a receipt. They took my money. I didn't leave with the license, which is a little bit of a head scratcher, but they took my money. They gave me a receipt. I was apparently successful, and I'm still extremely disgruntled. Moving forward, and racists, white supremacists are for sure most to blame for why that is such an agonizing experience for a lot of non-white people having to go to the Motor Vehicle Division, Department of Licensing, or Department of Motor Vehicles. Back to the book club. If you need the VOPE, it is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.ty.cc/oneRace. That is the number one. Address again, tiny.ty.cc/oneRace. That is the number one. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page. You will see the link for the free VOPE line. Click the link. It will open a small window on your screen. Window opens. You'll see on the top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in real name, nickname. You can press random keys. Once you get all that entered, click the green button. We'll connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. Same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6. Once you do so, I'll see your hand on the screen. You should hear the audio prompt. Press 1 once you hear the audio prompt after you press *6. But I'll see your hand on the screen. We'll get you on the line. You can share your thoughts on the first portion of Gil Scott Heron's reading. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to participate.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Just took a few notes. I'm figuring that he is probably about maybe a decade older than I am, but when he mentioned about going inside the house and the apartment or the house, I think, in New York, and viewing the black and white TV, that tells me, as far as the technology during this era that was accessible to the average everyday person, he and I have that in common. I was just thinking, as opposed to like some other stories, like Miss Coretta Scott King, it probably been a radio when they were young, because the television had not yet been accessible to the average everyday person. Other things that I noticed, that as of yet he hasn't really been specific about racism, white supremacy, with him a whole lot personally. He hasn't articulated that yet, but I'm pretty sure it's probably going to come up in the book on a more exclusive fashion. Number one, Mr. Scott Heron seems to like sports. I noticed almost every chapter he talks about it in some sort of way, a favorable way. He participated himself, he said, as a child in football and baseball. Of course, baseball during that time was still ahead of football as far as sports in this part of the world. Number two, black people I have here, black people still had growing food skills during his time. And I have here, nowadays, most of us only get our food from the grocery store. And that no black people own, although I just heard that somebody just started a black-owned grocery store. I think I heard about it. I don't know exactly when and where, but I've heard about it somewhere within the last month or so. Number three, grandmothers were center figures to black families during this time. His story is not unusual with a lot of the non-white black people. Number four, females as active athletes was not as common back then as it is now. I think he mentioned about a relative, a cousin or aunt. I think it probably was an aunt that was not only knowledgeable about sports, she actually participated in such activities. And I'm figuring that was somewhere around the late 50s, early 60s, and that was not, although we can mention about Wilma Rudolph and several others, but it wasn't common, nowhere close to where it is today. Number five, when he was talking about the school that he quote unquote integrated, it reminded me of the Little Rock situation where in that reading the black students actually signed up for that opportunity, and it came around to where they were called upon and they had to make a decision to do so. And we know about the Little Rock situation, and his was, I guess, similar, although he didn't stay very long. Last but not least, I'm reminded of he once again touched on the what was one of the main reasons on why he and his family had to move. And as I mentioned before, there was a similar situation down here in South Florida in the Overtown area. And in this case, it was a major expressway, I-95, to be exact, was the cause, which took place in around the same time, which is probably not ironic, late 50s, early 60s, whereas the code word was eminent domain, was used to uproot entire black families up out of their residence, a lot of their dreams and aspirations, you know, because the quote-unquote home is a very important institution. And to be uprooted out of it and have no other choice but to adhere to power is very traumatic, and it's a form of terror. And that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, if you have commentary you want to share, feel free.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Four.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I was looking at the book, enjoying it. And the picture on the front of the book is an image of Gil Scott-Heron with, you know, look like the titles of his songs and some of his sayings. And I thought that was pretty ingenious, you know, just the front of the book. But I'll start my commentary with when he first started out in chapter 7, he talked about the way that he remembered things. He said on page 46, despite the lack of mementos and photos from those early years, I have reached down into a barrel, it seems, and bring up scraps of yesterday once tossed aside like gum wrappers. The raw feeling like shock and sharp pain or fear suddenly grabbing your heart are closest to the top, easiest to reach. They return to me unbidden at times. And it started me to think that based on what he started to talk about later is the trauma that was starting in his life, starting with I think the death of his cat. And not only did he love the cat, but it was poisoned and he had to know that it was sitting there suffering underneath the back porch. I think that, you know, he's probably about 10 or 11 at that time. And that can be pretty traumatic. And unlike memories of racism, you know, that are buried deep into our subconscious, which you could probably identify as a form of post-traumatic stress because of all the constant mistreatment and trauma that victims end up enduring on a daily basis. It keeps it constant on your mind. I think the way the mind works, if you either suppress it deep within your mind, or it stays constantly on your mind all the time. And we know that he had a good memory, and he thought about things a lot. He was a thinker, so I can imagine the trauma of the images of Mr. Spann sitting there with open casket, and he's, you know, burned probably 75% of his body. The little girl, 7, that died of a heart attack, and sitting in a classroom and watching Aunt Sissy being carried out of a house, you know, feet first, and then to actually be in the house when his grandmother passed. I think these were traumatic events that, you know, at that time, if that happened today, it would be advisable for counseling, some type of psychiatric help, medical facilities, you know, for the child. But we know that he didn't get any of that. And then that can have a long-lasting effect and probably stay with him the rest of his life. And the fact that, you know, he was moving around quite a bit and met his mother at his grandmother's funeral, and he said that we were both there for our mother's funeral. So he's going through quite a bit, and he's having to feel his way through these things and try to somewhat make his own way. And he seems to be a very bright person, because when it came time to for integration, you know, I know we went through a similar thing where you had to sign up. You know, some people went for various reasons, but basically from the people who signed up, the black schools or the segregated schools would then choose from the, I guess based on your temperament and your grade point average, who was then going to the so-called white school and to, you know, go through this test, you know, to see whether this would work. And mind you, we have to remember that Brown versus Wade was in 56 or whatever. It's not until in the 60s until they actually started implementing blacks being brought into white schools. And it was much longer than that in Texas, where I grew up. It was about 67, 68 before we actually started going down there. And only later in life we realized that it was actually a disadvantage to be one of those people who went, you know, into that type of environment. But I think that's all I have, man. I'll mute my line. Thanks for letting me talk.
For sure. Good to hear the commentary, Mr. Demery Ford, and retired firefighter. If other folks have commentary, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 56493#. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I took notes as well. Just to begin, since the Little Rock 9 situation has been mentioned, that previously on our book club we did Elizabeth and Hazel, and we also did Warriors Don't Cry, back to back, in fact, in 2013, we did both of those texts. So we spent quite a bit of time on quote unquote integration and hearing how different people experienced it and some of the lifelong trauma as a result of that right here on the book club. Also, I wanted to emphasize, I thought that was a really important point Mr. Demery Ford made about the loss of these family members at such a young age. Having a huge impact. I think I'm not sure if it comes up in the book or not, but he had well documented substance abuse issues in adulthood, Mr. Scott Heron, and that, you know, could be likely directly related to one, him being a victim of white supremacy, and then all of these childhood traumas. Last week, his father not being around either, not even being on the continent, going to pursue his dreams to play football, and then losing his mom, and his mom not even being there. He's living with his grandmother and thinking of her as his mother, and his actual biological mother being out of the state in Chicago. I mean, that, and then these deaths of all these people that are really close to him. I mean, that's that, and the moving around, as you all said, being in Mississippi and then Tennessee, and then, I mean, that is a lot. In addition to racism, white supremacy, and you grow up, you are living in the state of Mississippi, as he said last week, where he felt black and mistreated. And he said he was in the state of Mississippi when Medgar Evers was killed and when Emmett Till was lynched, that he was a child growing up in Mississippi. So, I mean, we're talking about just an astronomical amount of trauma that is probably very, very common. I don't think this is anything that unusual, Mr. Gil Scott Heron's story. I mean, this is the whole book of The Warmth of Other Suns. This sounds almost identical to a whole lot of incidents that we heard in that book about black people fleeing this type of terrorism to get someplace better, ostensibly. So going to the notes, things that stood out in this week's section, he says... Oh, I skipped over a few things. Okay. From chapter 7, when he's talking about the attachment to, he said, like, some of the black people, they weren't really city folks. They weren't, you know, that's not really where their heart was, per se. I thought retired firefighter made a great point about the food. Black people previous generations growing their own food and not being so dependent was really important. I think some of our guests have even emphasized how that was helpful to a lot of black people, because if you did not have enough nickels, that did not mean that you had to starve or, you know, really have difficulty in trying to figure out how to provide food for your family, because you had a lot more black people who had gardens and livestock and what have you. So that, you know, could help greatly supplement meals for the family, and not having as much of that makes us a lot more dependent on the system of racism, white supremacy, and getting our needs met. I thought that was a really important point. But also just the use of the term spades, where he's talking about spades in terms of a garden instrument, right? Where he says to turn full spades of thick black soil over and slice it with their shovel tips to a depth of 8 inches. I just thought the language of racism, white supremacy, that term spades also has been used as a racist way of describing black people, and sometimes the garden instrument as well, and also, you know, playing cards also, but associating with blackness and some sort of farm labor is implied in the different uses of the word generally, whether you're talking about people or whatever it is. Also, I thought it was important, Dr. Welsing moment, perhaps, when he was talking about the fertility of the soil and how it was soil for growing. And he talked about the blackness of the soil. Welsing moment, I thought. Let's see. Chapter 8. When he was talking about his mom, when she comes in, right, to talk about the school situation, is he going to, quote unquote, integrate? And he says that his mother had a tone of anti-panic, like she could be heard actively being calm. Like, that to me sounds like some form of codification in terms of I'm going to, you know, get myself together. I'm going to collect my thoughts and proceed meticulously with how I deal with this, what I say, what I don't say. That to me sounds like someone being codified, or at least attempting codification. And then this conversation that ensues, where she says, my mother asked whether I still wanted to go to a white school. She never said I was going. She just asked whether I wanted to go. And if I wanted to go, I had to start the next day. I thought that was really interesting to give her young son that much autonomy with the decision to not try to force either way, or, you know, this is what I think you should do, or whatever. Just, you know, this is the information as I have it, and, you know, what decision do you want to make with it? Like, that allowing quite a bit of independence. I also, again, we have covered quite a bit, like, in depth. We've read several books on the book club about quote unquote school integration. And I contrast that, right, to the details when he lays out how the thinking, right, of the council in terms of what they were going to do, how they were going to have this process of allowing a few of the Negro children to come into their school, right? So he says, this is just a couple of pages over from that. He writes, the council had some specifics when striking the deal with the NAACP lawyer. Only junior high students, and Tigrit would be the test school in part, I'm sure because of its location far from Main Street. The council also wanted to go immediately with as close to zero noise about it as possible. Like, they had, when, I'm blanking on his name, but he always says think tanks. White people have think tanks to process and strategize and come up with the best way to go about practicing racism, the best way to abuse and terrorize as many black people as possible. And black people do not have these type of think tanks. Dr. Claude Anderson, thank you. Black people do not have these type of think tanks in place. Clearly that is on display with this school integration. And it's on display in each of the incidents, in each of the cases that you look, where the white people have already planned this out, where we're not going to get all the bad press. They're not going to have the images of Elizabeth Eckford, like you saw with the Little Rock Nine in Arkansas. We're not going to have those images in Tennessee of, you know, red-faced racist yelling at some poor little school child. We're not going to have that here. We're going to make sure that we get our money and make everything look refined here as we run the business of racism, white supremacy, far from Main Street, so this doesn't become a big public spectacle, getting, you know, more Negroes down here protesting and what have you, refining as they go. The white people have a plan. The black people find out the night before, like, make a decision, Negroes. What are you going to do? You got 5 minutes, you know, to come up with what you want to go. That right there is racism, white supremacy. You are in. When Dr. Kanban says we're at a disadvantage, when the white people, you get to get a think tank and strategize a plan about how this is going to happen and the timetable and everything. And black people, victims of white supremacy, you find out you get 5 minutes to make a decision. Here are the details. You got 5 minutes to make up your mind what you're going to do. Add that on the list of trauma as well. Continuing. He says, when he says, I have come to the conclusion that the spirits played a part in integrating Tigrette, in making it work so smoothly. I don't know what to make of that sentence, particularly when I look back over here at what made this go smoothly. It seems to me, just from what he wrote in the book, was racist man, racist woman. This council, which I said, and he didn't even say white people. He said the council. And he said it multiple times. He said, I found out later that right after New Year's Day, the city council, he didn't say white people, wanted to make a deal. It was a secret that stayed that way until we were already in classes, leaving no chance for opposition to build. If they could integrate the schools quietly without confrontation, they could save money, avoid any bad publicity for the city, and keep down potential for rednecks to stir up trouble. It sounds like some very powerful white people made this go smoothly, not the quote unquote spirits, unless the spirits was referencing, racist man, racist woman. I don't think that's what he meant. But that sentence about the spirits playing a role, that gave me some trouble. That I'll leave it there. Let's see if other folks, let me pause to see if other folks had commentary they wanted to share. Okay, I don't see any other hands. I'll get the rest of my comments in and double check before we do have the second audio segment, but if folks have other commentary that they want to share, feel free also. Other things that I had around the school integration, let's see. With the, I guess this is kind of the conclusion for chapter 8, where he says, I don't want to prop up the Jackson City Council, again, not saying white people, as societal visionaries, but their plan worked pretty smoothly, and it had a move that advanced this. It was a move that advanced the city's economic potential as a thousandfold. It made clear that Jackson's politicians knew the Civil War was over. Metaphor. The system of racism, white supremacy, clearly is not over. I think this is, sometimes where it's being accurate with the way that we talk about things. And another reason why I caution about metaphors, to me, again, it just sounds like you had powerful white people who decided this will be best. We can best operate the plantation in this part of Tennessee by allowing as few Negroes as possible to go to one school. We'll control it as tightly as possible, so we'll have as few Negroes as possible. We'll make it all go smooth. It won't stir up any trouble. No problems. We won't have any press. We won't be on TV. That rabble-rousing Negro King and the rest of his Negroes, they won't be down here messing up things. We'll make all this go clean, smooth, and it'll be great for the business of white supremacy. That's what it sounds like to me, and I think a lot of times we fail to articulate or even understand that. We're victims, still learning, myself too. Chapter 9, let's see. This portion where he's talking about Uncle B when they moved to New York, right? He's helping his mom out when they move after his grandmother's death. He says Uncle B had a job at the Social Security office, and he had a job that was within walking distance of their residence. Which kind of reminded me of Mr. Fuller. He also had a government job and was able to walk to work. I think he talked about that on one of the previous CALS programs, which can be important. Workplace racism, distance to your residence, and even racial dislocation. A lot of what's happening right now, making sure that very few black people have that sort of situation where their living arrangement is so comfortable that they are a 15-minute walk from their job. They're trying to make sure that white people have those types of situations. In fact, just never mind. That's off topic. I'll share that tomorrow. I just heard that specifically about workplace racism. Let's see. What else did I have from chapter 9? Where he says he thought Uncle B might have been drinking too much because he didn't see any children when he first got there. He thought maybe he had imagined this. It was a hallucination. Sobriety would be best. I thought when he was describing being outside, he goes to New York and he's outside. He hates the cold. I empathize. He said he's outside. He's playing rubber ball against a wall. I said, my goodness, if it doesn't already, in about 10 years, that is going to sound like some caveman activities. Like, you are doing what? Do they even do that like anymore? I can't imagine a child being outside throwing a rubber ball again, or any of the other things that he described. And I mean, this is going to be like total caveman Neanderthal childhood activities. If it's not already in about 10 years, woo, unless I'm in error. Continuing the whole conversation with about whether he's going to leave Creston or get moved up, I guess, to a better grade. Like, he's, you know, so smart, he's not getting any homework. This is the work at school is kind of a bore because he's so intelligent. I thought that was a very interesting exchange with this I'm a racist white man, and the way that he's talking to him, it just to me just showed the horror of, you know, what is all of this for? What is the goal here of pursuing? We talked about that extensively with the two books I mentioned already, but of pursuing quote unquote integration with our children, to send them to this sort of educator. Like, this is supposed to help us with our problems and improve the plight of black people. Yes. And even with that, he seemed very codified. He seemed appropriately suspicious. And that right there will solve a lot of problems. Just that alone puts you in a much better position when you have to confront, have an exchange with any individual classified as white, when you are operating from suspicion. Like, I think that this person could be an enemy to me, an enemy to black people. I'm going to be very careful. I'm going to listen attentively to every word that they say. I'm going to keep my eye. It sounds like that's the way that he approached this conversation, and that was to his benefit, I think. If folks had any comments on that, that would be grand. I will leave my comments there. Anybody else? Anything else stood out? Was I talking crazy? And anybody have any thoughts on this exchange he has with this white educator about whether, you know, he's smart enough to be advanced in their academic institution?
What do you want to make commentary on now? Say it again.
Well, specifically the conversation, if folks recall, like when his mom had gone to the school to say, you know, hey, he's not getting any homework, and I think he's smart enough that, you know, he could be challenged more. So they go talk, this white educator, he goes and talks to his teachers, and he calls Gil in to have this conversation about, you know, do you want to do this? And, you know, I went and talked to the teachers and what have you, and everybody thinks that their child is more Einstein than Frankenstein. If folks remember that passage, just what did people think about that exchange in the book? Did he seem appropriately suspicious of it? Anything else stand out from that exchange?
How was Mr. Scott Heron's attitude towards it? Did he basically agree with the administrator, or?
Well, that was
because I thought that the mother and what she did was very commendable, and is something that it's very essential even today for a parent to do, because obviously she was paying attention to his schooling, being very vigilant on his educational background, just to be able to come in there. But I didn't pay attention much to what he had to say about it. But go ahead, Gus. You're about to say something.
Oh, right on. You answered the question. And right on. I thought that was great with his mom as well, sticking up for her child and noticing that he was not being challenged, which happens a lot with black scholars, black children, where the academic system is not set up for black success. That, you know, should be glaring at this point. Other folks had commentary. Folks had any thoughts specifically about that exchange with this white educator? And young Gil Scott Heron, if not, that's fine too. Or if you had other commentary, anybody else wanted to share?
Yes, I had something to say about that. I think that he said his mother's presence in the school wasn't because of his lack of enthusiasm in the studies. It was because he never had any homework. So it looked as though he was an advanced student, or he was very intelligent, and the school had him in remedial classes. So like they do a lot of kids, young black men that don't get the benefit of being encouraged and to put into classes in areas that will help them advance their desires and interests and talents, like him in writing and singing and all that. They just had him in a remedial class. And then his mother goes to look into that, and then come to find out, it looks like that the white male was trying to do some investigation. It's like, you know, we use a shell, you Negroes, you know, but you seem to be a little different. I've talked to some of your teachers and all that. You know, you have the ability. You're Einstein instead of Frankenstein or whatever. You know, see, they want to put you in this category to begin with. And then as a young man, if you know this, and, you know, you can get past some of these obstacles. That's what I think about it. One other thing I wanted to say was the fact that he knew how he felt. You know, a lot of people, even grown-ups, are not able to say how they feel about something. But he said, I knew that how you feel wasn't the great question to ask most people. It was a rhetorical, irrelevant, a question of mundane as it was insignificant to most people, but not to me. So he had a lot of questions. But the conclusion of the matter, he says down later, was that, you know, there was no villains and he had nobody to target his disappointment. He was just one of 1,000 people from South Jackson who had to get the hell out of the way. And I felt better about myself by the time the train reached Chicago, halfway to New York. So regardless to when you become conscious of, you know, how you feel and the way you want things to be, it's irrelevant. And you may as well just get used to it the way you're being pushed around and moved around. Yeah, you can feel a certain way, but you're still going to have to move on. And I'll mute my line.
I think the people that would be most to blame for that highway situation and all those black people having to relocate, that would be racist man, racist woman, because that is a pattern that we've covered on the book club, and we mentioned that last week when we first, you know, heard the hint that this was going to happen. And that's another pattern where white people directly are not held accountable. That word does not get applied to white people regularly. I hear a lot of talk about holding black people accountable, but white people generally are never held accountable for practicing racism, white supremacy. And I even thought with that exchange with this white educator and young Gil Scott, where he says he's talking about his mom coming up here and, you know, advocating on his behalf, black self-respect. And he says, this is the educator he has where he's quoting him, where he says, her dress, talking about Gil Scott's mom, her dress and bearing and vocabulary, everything. I was really beginning to think that she knew what she was talking about. Like, that has, I mean, that is like textbook racism, white supremacy. Like, she spoke so well. I am accustomed to you Negroes not being able to put together a sentence, but, you know, she seemed like she was dressed halfway decently and spoke all right, like she might have more than a nickel in her pocket. I was already stunned. just wow. And I'm this, to me, the fact that he doesn't name him, it just makes him very indistinct, very representative of why the racist academic situation has not changed, and this is about what we still got. 2017, the wonders of integration. Yes, so I can go and have this person deal with my lovely black child for the, you know, first formative years of their life. Yes, Wonderful. Before I request again, I wanted to make sure I was on my job. Smokey Robinson was mentioned. Right on. Any other comments? Folks wanted to make sure they get in. We can move to the second audio segment. Any other comments? Folks wanted to make sure that they get in.
Yeah, that song that he mentioned with Smokey Robinson was one of his greatest all-time hits also. I forgot what the title was, but I recall when he said it I actually was playing the tune in my head, but it was a hit during that time. Just want to say that I personally had a similar situation to Mr. Heron with the remedial classes, which is probably a standard tactic, and I'm pretty sure it's still used today in public school systems with black children, that they would quickly get put into remedial classes with the idea of mind, and why I challenge the Negro, you know, I'll make the class work challenging, just keep it down to a low level. But I had around me a lot of siblings who, or two that were ahead of me, who were very excellent students in school. And once they would get wind of what was going on with me, they would tell it to mother. And the problem would be solved because I wasn't going to say anything. You know, the whole idea about the grade situation, you know, being very easy, you know, just simple math and subtraction, that sort of thing, whereas I should have been doing something like algebra. A very similar situation in that light. And it also reminded me in this particular last reading with his experiences of quote-unquote integration, it reminded me of mine by having I had the unfortunate background of having the first white instructor at the elementary school that I went to, fifth grade, which is during that time in Dade County Public School, from 1 to 5th grade was elementary school, and went to the 5th grade for this white lady. I still remember her name. They call her Dr. Mary. And one thing I distinctly remember about her was her bad breath, because she used to get into my face all the time, because it was something that she always had to criticize me about. You know, that sort of thing. And also with Dade County Public Schools in 1970, as I was going to the 7th grade, is when it quote unquote integrated through the whole school system. And but his situation, I'm surprised that in the quote unquote old South that it happened during that time with him. I was kind of like surprised that it was going on during that time. In the older South, as far as that's concerned. And most of the people that we read about who seems to be less confused about racism, in their early childhood, they had experiences directly with white people. And prefer, in his case, it was in school with Malcolm, but Malcolm X, it was basically in the area where they stayed at, you know, playing with white children, so to speak. So that gave them a very extensive background history of being around and being in close contact with white people. And in turn, it really matured their understanding as they became older. And that's all I'd say. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Yeah, I think many of the folks that we've had, that we have done autobiographies for, Coretta Scott King. Well, I don't know. Coretta Scott King had some traumatic episodes with white people, and she seemed to, she did do a lot of work against racism. She just didn't, I guess she wasn't particularly on anything pointing out white people's dedication to racism. She seemed very willing from her last week, very willing to be about love and embracing and all coming together in spirit of brotherhood, sisterhood,
right,
sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, victim of racism, VGQ, right on. But she did devote a lot of her time to working against racism. So I guess having those issues, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to come out with a what I would say is an accurate understanding of what it means to be white and collective white pathology and dedication to terrorizing black people. But it can be very helpful, I would say, in motivating black people to saying, hey, I'm going to have to do something with my life to working against racism. I think that is absolutely true. Yeah, did folks have any, just make sure I'm not, you know, talking crazy. Throwing a rubber ball against a wall, is that caveman now, or do folks think in about 10 years that's going to be thought of as caveman activity, or am I talking wild?
Oh no, you are somewhat accurate. I just today was coming down the street to my place of residence, and it's a habit of me seeing a couple of children. They're obviously their brothers and sisters are very close to. I see the same children, and this is the only sight that you will see on my street. It's about three or four of them, and they actually are playing outside. You know, and one thing about it through the reading is what he was sharing with us is common, that when you are a stranger in an area, the quickest way that you get in the groove as far as socially with other children, especially, is when they find out that you're good at what you're doing in a sport that they may have invited you to play in. That's one of the quickest means to get accepted, and apparently that's what took place with him. But yeah, no, you're not talking crazy. That is unusual. Now, it is sports that takes place with young people. For instance, you know, I mentioned down here all the time, it's football, but it's very organized, out on a park, you know, that sort of thing. And they like to think that they're more proficient than the NFL, as one would study about South Florida down here. But it's not like it used to be when I was a child in the 60s and in the early 70s that, you know, where you just go outside and play all day long. You know, that's not going to happen nowadays. No.
Right on. Unless anybody has other comments, we can move along to the second audio segment. We're on chapter 10. Did other listeners, any other folks have commentary that they wanted to get in before we move forward? I will assume folks are satisfied. If you have commentary that you didn't get to share, you can jot down a note and we will include it as we go. With that, Gil Scott Heron, The Last Holiday, a Memoir, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2. 10. I don't know what to read into this, but there have been a lot of Jacksons in my life. I lived in Jackson, Tennessee. The guy I wrote songs with later was Brian Jackson. In 1984, I voted for and did a fundraising benefit for Reverend Jesse Jackson. My road manager for a long time and a good friend for a longer time was named Ernest Jackson. And while living in the Bronx, before all the Jackson people, I worked at a place named Jackson's. The place we lived with my uncle on Hampton Place looked like the private driveway for someone who lived on Fordham Road just east of the Major Deegan Expressway and the 207th Street Bridge from Manhattan. If you continued east on Fordham Road, you faced a left turn and a sharp incline that led to University Avenue, Jerome Avenue, and the Grand Concourse, and the Fordham Shopping District. Halfway up that incline on the right-hand side was an attractive-looking restaurant, Jackson's Steak and Lobster House. A prime attraction of Jackson's was a huge picture-window lobster tank where customers were invited to select the lobster they wanted for dinner. Great. I saw the lobsters in the tank scrambling over each other desperately
as though they knew what fate awaited them. I was not motivated by things that dipped into my mother's finances. I was not worked up about my wardrobe and didn't mind taking a little teasing on the basketball courts because I didn't wear Chuck Taylors. Converse All-Stars were the Air Jordans of that era. I had inherited a couple of nice jackets and a good assortment of sweaters from my uncle, but unfortunately, my uncle didn't have any Chucks to hand down. We didn't wear the same size shoes anyway. It benefited my mom that I was not on her for this or that, but that wasn't why I didn't ask. I knew her expenses expanded when my uncle left, but I hadn't been after her for stuff before he left either. I had what I needed to get by. A good selection of broom handles that served as stickball bats, a good leather basketball, an expanding collection of Marvel comics, and a radio that kept me on the field with the Mets, my adopted baseball team. I managed to hold myself together by hustling. I made deliveries up the hill to old ladies on my bike, the same one I brought along from Tennessee. It had a basket on the front where orders from the corner grocery rode while I pedaled. In the evening, I met the newspaper trucks for the night editions and rolled them back to a corner candy store on Fordham Road and Sedgwick. In those days, the Daily News, the Mirror, the Post, and the Herald Tribune all had night editions that were dated as the early edition for the next day. There were no individual deliveries to the stores. Instead, there was a central drop on Fordham Road where the trucks were met by youngsters with wagons who hauled the various copies back to the neighborhood shops where huddling groups of retirees waited for them. Between what I covered with the wagon and pedaled up that hill, I kept pocket money that I often doubled by betting on stickball games at the park in the afternoons. But then came a job, or rather, the job. That was when I was called to replace the man who was the dishwasher on the night shift at Jackson's. I was actually too young to work there, too young to be in a place that sold cocktails past midnight. But while laughing, I had smeared some of my mother's eyeshadow across my upper lip where there were so few hairs. I knew them all by name. The owner knew I was too young. The manager knew. Not how young I was, but how old I wasn't. But they called when they needed somebody suddenly. At times, I might do an 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. shift, their heavy time. The time when I would ordinarily be studying or listening to the radio or working on one of my stories about a private detective with a comic book name and 5 pages to catch his man. Instead, I was in the pits, in the elbow of a dishwashing machine that mostly moaned and groaned as it trudged along on a conveyor that mostly conveyed how hot and how tired and how thick with grease everything was. From the moment I walked in there, it felt flat out awful. I went to the back through the swinging doors that separated the dining area from the dying area. It was hot, unnaturally so. You dig? The kind of heat that changes your mood and your attitude. A non-discriminating, hope to God some cold beer's waiting that I can bathe in hot. Like a combination microwave and a dame with big tits on Spanish Fly rubbing up against you like she wants to melt you hot. It had something to do with the combination of heat from the grill with all the burners blasting and the steam at my post. The dishwasher corner where these two flaps were located reminded you of the tunnel of love. When I raised a flap to my right, I could shove a wooden square about my size into the darkness that always roared over the sweating dishes. To the left, the dishes emerged with a whoosh of steam that literally seemed to smack me dizzy every 1.5 minutes. There was a young Italian waiter who came through our work area as though he was on roller skates with some customer's lobster headed for a huge pot of scalding water, always singing, "That's your fucking ass, baby." At Jackson's, I came to understand the term sweatshop, though this wasn't one, and they never treated me bad for even 1 second. But I also came to understand why they have child labor laws wherever they have them. At about 11 p.m., it was as if the spirits whispered my name to the manager just as the big hand of the steam release struck me full in the face and made me so nauseous that my knees literally wobbled. "How about a steak, kid?" the manager asked. "Right through your fucking heart," I croaked back. And everybody howled, and somebody slapped me on the back, and I almost vomited. I stumbled and bumbled my way to the back window, where the change in the taste of the air, the smell of it, the feel of it against my face and chest like water after a desert trek made me feel nearly ecstatic. I praised the steak and potatoes and veggies the cook fixed especially for me. He was a gigantic Jamaican who always sang off-key and could handle a half dozen orders at once and still keep his grills spotless and his platters looking as if he pulled them from an ad in a magazine. I ate every bite of everything, finishing with nothing but butter on my fingers from the rolls. I soon learned how to beat the heat by walking to the open door after every second tray of dishes about 1 every 5 minutes. I learned how to flog the smog, joke about the smoke, and to pour a cool glass of water over lettuce leaves and put them in my hat. I had made it through every shift because my mother and I needed that money. The 5 hours I put in should have earned me about $7.50, but they always gave me $10. The men I worked with called me man, and they treated me like one, so I went back every time I was called, usually once or twice a month. After finishing junior high at Creston, I had to decide which of two Bronx high schools to attend, Benjamin Franklin or DeWitt Clinton. After a year of all-boys education at Creston, I had sort of figured out I'd go to the co-ed Franklin. I was not aware of any intellectual advantage professed by Clinton, but the basketball team there was good, but there were no girls. My mother did not weigh all factors, I'm sure. She had heard some derogatory comments about Franklin, and that convinced her that I was not going there. Based on where I was not going, I ended up enrolled at Clinton. An education factory of 8,000 boys who attended classes in 3 shifts, 7:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., and 10:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. My first semester, I drew the middle shift. Registration for classes at Clinton brought my greatest fear of New York being swallowed alive. In my mind, I had seen myself as one of thousands of people stampeding down a boulevard like a human tidal wave, unable even to break stride, running both 1 step ahead and 1 step behind the next person. The worst aspect of this was that it wasn't an emergency, not an escape to anywhere away from anything. It was just everyday survival. I felt as if I was signing up for work on an assembly line. I felt like I had imagined New York would make me feel a struggle against becoming nobody. That was the difference I should have been able to express from my first day in New York. I had been looking for that at Creston, but walking or riding to and from school with other guys from the block had calmed that strangeness I dreaded. It was back at Clinton. It came back on the registration line. I was an insignificant cipher, a six-digit dimwit with no connection to this concoction, with no place that was mine. In Jackson, I had been somebody recognized and respected. Maybe my problem was ego. Maybe my problem was being spoiled. But I felt otherwise. I felt that how successful you were depended on how comfortable you were. Some people were just small town people, and there was nothing wrong with that. In the middle of that afternoon's line of fires, I felt completely anonymous, as though I was being erased, as though I was losing contact by making contact, resigning by signing in. By joining, I became disjointed. By taking a number, I became one. I was in New York because my mother wanted this. She was here because she wanted it for me. I had all kinds of problems at Clinton. It's no good to point at a general malaise like a depression, feeling stressed, or full court pressed by a crowd in New York. It's too common. So I attributed it to the teachers. It's the teacher's fault, I told my mother. I can't relate. She blew up. I could talk about serious things with her for as long as I needed, but saran wrap problems, problems she knew I should have seen through, did not fly. You don't like your teachers. Aw, that's too bad. The teacher isn't there for you to like her. If you do, that's all right. But that's not what she's there for. What you need to do is read the books she read. Just ask her about supplements she would recommend, added to her syllabus. And remember to take your weakest course in the morning and your strongest classes in the afternoon. That means, for you, the math and science is in the morning and English and history are late courses. Right? Right. That was an important conference, and the suggestion she made about when I should sign up for which subjects was crucial. The next semester, I decided I would sign up for a last period English class, which was how I met Miss Nettie and got the opportunity to go to Fieldston, and I almost blew that. 11. During that first semester of high school, my mother and I headed to Alabama with Aunt Sammy to see the Hamiltons, and we stopped in Jackson, Tennessee on the way. The visit came at a time when I was really desperate, unable to get comfortable in the Bronx. I went through periods of time when it was all right to be in New York, and other times when I just knew I didn't belong there, that perhaps nobody did. I thought during those times that I belonged in Jackson. Arriving back in Jackson felt curious, a revelation I needed. After following the Smoky Mountains down past the point where Bristol, Virginia, bellies up to Bristol, Tennessee, we came into Jackson on Interstate 70, which now cut a 500-mile, 8-lane diagonal route across Tennessee. The completion of Route 70 had brought about major change in Jackson. There had been growth I could see from the highway. Industry, jobs, money. We pulled into the house of a friend of my grandmother after midnight. I hardly slept before I was up at what the Amish would call early. I bathed and was dressed to go out immediately. I was anxious to walk on my streets and breathe my air. It was midweek, a school day, and I made my way out to Mary High School, the black high school, and arrived just after the opening bell. all of my old gang was there. Even Glover, my best friend and lifelong rival, the guy who had integrated to Gret Junior High School with me and Madeline, was there. I found that he was king of the hallways. I had grown in the 18 months since I'd left, but he was still an inch taller and about 10 pounds heavier. And now he wore a social maturity that made me feel like I had been left way behind. Perhaps I had been. Glover said he'd had sex. I still had only ambition. But what I really envied was how loose and comfortable he was. They all were. They were home. I hadn't been comfortable since I left. I wanted to feel that way again. The real joy, what I thought I missed most, was seeing and talking to girls. They felt good even without touching. In New York, I spoke to girls with a mouth full of doubt, trying to see the words I spoke and sap the drawl off of them. This morning, all the girls were as pretty and soft as I remembered, but now with added bulges in their blouses and hips that made skirts dance as they walked. I used a month's worth of New York smiles as we strutted around, and I threw, "Hey, and how you doing?" and every which way like a politician. I went back to join Aunt Sammy and my mother for dinner and eagerly reported on my day as a celebrity from New York City. After dinner, I got cleaned up and dressed to go back out to Mary High for the Southern Serenades, a school-wide talent show with students singing the latest tunes. I knew I would have been doing something solo or with a group if I had still been around. I wasn't doing any singing at Clinton. Something strange happened. Somewhere near the end of the show, it all got tired. Jackson, Mary High, the Southern serenading, even the girls. They were still soft and cute, yes, but that was what was wrong with it. They were the same. I imagined that in 20 years I could walk in and nothing would have changed at all. Without leaving my seat, and while the music played and somebody sang, I imagined myself back up the highway in the Bronx, and I wasn't called country anymore, or not without a smile. And everything I could imagine in the world was a subway ride away. I would be all right when these few days were over and I was back in New York. I didn't live in Jackson anymore. You can go home again, I thought, but only to visit. 12. The tiny school PA system at Clinton made voices sound like they were talking from the bottom of a well, and I can still remember the principal coming on there as I walked into history one afternoon in November 1963. Still damp from swimming class. He was saying something about a terrible event in Texas. The president and some other people had been shot, not yet clear about the extent of the injuries. Awful thing to have happened. The history teacher was watery-eyed and red-faced, blowing her nose, not saying anything, not taking attendance. I edged sideways around some folks to my seat in the crowded room. Hell, I thought to myself, this is a real shame. Is my whole high school life going to be this way? After a while, the voice was rising up from the well again. May I have your attention, please? I regret to inform you that your president is dead. There were more words, but our teacher had heard enough. She took a step or two backward and sat down, waving toward the door. School was over. Somebody had killed the president. I did not recognize all the implications of a presidential assassination, but I recognized death.
This one took over everything. It came into everyone's house and sat down. It squeezed into every radio on every station, and every television station had the same pictures at the same time. Pictures of Oswald. Pictures of Johnson, formerly the vice president, being sworn in on an airplane. Pictures of the governor who got shot. Pictures of Kennedy's wife. Pictures of the book repository empty again. The third floor window. The policeman who arrested Oswald. More pictures of Oswald. The parkway. A replay of the motorcade from the other side of the parkway opposite the book repository, elevated, squared up on the space where the cars will first appear. Not a lot of area open because this hill obstructs and there's a viaduct with bareheaded men wearing raincoats with what are probably sawed-off Uzis. Glints of chrome and movement, people turning. The mid-range drone of the crowd lining the route rises in volume as the lead car appears and enters a patch of sunshine. People wave and applaud, and from inside, the applause distant but distinct. Crack, crack, crack. Three shots, with the second and third sounding as though they overlap. Theories, speculation, inquiries, explanations. Oswald being led in handcuffs off an elevator into a crowded hallway lined with the curious, the furious. There's a deputy in a white hat who seems disturbed by the glare of the lights and looks down to his left. The group pushes its way through the taut rows of bystanders, forming a parade-like path for lawmen and their prisoner. Then an awkward intruder produces a gun and fires point-blank, belt high. Oswald crumples forward as his assailant is wrestled down. I've just seen a man murdered. When I started the second semester a few weeks later, things did not look good. I walked into my English class at 2 p.m. and found a young white chick who looked like a student herself. Naturally, she didn't look like a Clinton student, but there was an all-girls high school down the parkway, and she could have gotten by as an inmate from there. I figured she must be a temporary replacement or a tutor or someone doing a field project for a sociology class. She was short, wore glasses, had a small voice, and maintained a counterfeit all-business front. If I had known the Mormons had an off-the-compound work program, I might have pegged her for a missionary. She did not look like someone who had been destined to pull faculty duty at an institution for 8,000 mostly black and Latin boys in a joint laid out more like a penitentiary than a school. On top of everything else, her name was Nettie Leaf. What I came to enjoy about Miss Leaf was the way she took herself and her classes so seriously. It was far better to have a teacher who cared about the class, about the material, about you, who cared about something, than another ho-hum hour of holding on and trying to stay awake. English was not number one among the half-wits at DeWitt Clinton, but it was cool with me. If Miss Leaf thought English was number one, how could I complain? So I showed up and didn't fuck with her. Maybe I stood out because I read The Damn Homework, The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, and A Separate Piece by John Knowles. The homework was a real clue about Miss Leaf. Wherever she came from, the students might have really been into those stories, but this place was the exact opposite of wherever. I didn't ask the other students how they felt about it, but I thought The Lottery
was Justice for Once. A Separate Piece was the book that got me to the point where my communications with Miss Leaf turned into static. I thought the book was white noise about white people, about her, not us. I don't know why that particular book was the last straw. It was no more irrelevant than anything else I read in school. At Creston, I had read Great Expectations and Leon Uris for crying out loud. I had performed in The Mikado without delving into the inherent racism of either Gilbert or Sullivan, neither of whom had a fan club in the ghetto. But this was not an ethnic protest or part of the Up with Harlem movement. Hell, I didn't even live in Harlem. And aside from Langston Hughes's column in the Chicago Defender, I wasn't familiar with a lot of black literature. For 2 or 3 days in a row, I sat there like I didn't know. 2 or 3 hours went past, and I didn't say nothing in class. She thought that I didn't read it, so when she pushed me about where I was at, I said I could write better than that. And when she said she didn't believe, I gave her some of my stuff to read. Miss Leaf apparently liked my writing, or thought she should, or something. A few days later, Miss Leaf asked me to stay after class. She asked where I came from and what else I had written and whether I had heard of Fieldston and would I be willing to meet somebody. The answers were Jackson, Tennessee, a lot of stuff, no, and meet who? When she explained that Fieldston, not Fieldston, as I heard it, was a school, I joked with her, "Is that your Auld Lang Syne?" Fortunately, she got the joke. You had to be very careful about joking with white folks. They took everything, especially themselves, very seriously. And at the same time, they resented a brother taking himself that same way. "Yes, that's right," she said. "It's in Riverdale, and it's a private school. I think it would be good for you. What would you think of that?" What did I think of that? I'd never thought about it. I didn't think I would be eligible, so I didn't say anything. But the more I listened to Miss Leaf, the more I thought she was the type of person people always thought I was. A hick, just off the Trailways bus from some town where the bus stopped at a combination general store post office 3 times a week and who thought everybody on TV had to be real short to fit in there. When she suggested a meeting with an old friend of hers who was a teacher at Fieldston, I thought, what the hell? After all, if I could last a few more months, I might get an A in her class, which is how I ended up in a Howard Johnson's on Fordham Road across from the Bronx Zoo. I had already had a cheeseburger and was dealing with a strawberry sundae sitting in a booth on either leather or linoleum opposite Miss Leaf and a short, sandy-haired man with glasses named Professor Heller. He was studying me like he wasn't studying me. I watched him watching me and tried to watch out. I also took my time with that ice cream. I was enjoying it, which was what they suggested. I thought I was wondering why they were just having Cokes. I was getting curious as it went along, though. When Miss Leaf had brought up the possibility of attending Fieldston, I thought she was either kidding or just trying to be nice, which is what some white folks did when they were kidding. I hadn't taken the idea of this meeting too seriously. First of all, because I didn't think anybody who was plugged in that well to Fieldston would be trying to get 30 thugs to pay attention in a last period English class at Clinton. If so, she must have committed some kind of felony
for which she was paying penitence. Maybe she had to recruit someone as part of her penalty, but I didn't see her as a top recruiter any more than I saw Clinton as prime recruiting territory, or any more than I saw myself as a good recruit. I was a long shot. How long? How about the odds against a jackass in the Kentucky Derby? That meant that nothing happening there at Hojo's was more important than that strawberry sundae. I was in a hell of a position. If I paid too much attention to the sundae, I would ignore the people who bought it. But if I didn't stay on it, it would melt, which would be unfortunate and also make it seem as if I didn't want it. I did. The meeting had put me between a rock and a hard place at home, too, with my mother. It had been a good move to say I was interested. My mother had heard about the school when she worked at the library on 231st Street. She knew Fieldston was real and was a real good school. My uncle, who was real sarcastic, said he didn't believe in fairy tales unless they included a real fairy. I got it. So there we were, me, Miss Leaf, and Professor Heller, whose eyes seemed magnified behind his glasses. Flicking a look my way every now and then, the two of them were good friends, and as the time eased along, I went from uncomfortable and irritable to amiable and agreeable. When I figured out halfway through that Sunday was that nothing was happening that day, no matter what they said or thought, unless I said I definitely would not do it or got smart alecky. I decided not to ask them whether it was true there were no black people in Riverdale. Professor Heller asked questions. He was a nice, soft-spoken gentleman who made me feel a little ashamed of my suspicions. I was looking at him like New Yorkers look at everything, like it's fake and he couldn't possibly be a nice person appreciating my writing. "And you're from West Tennessee?" he asked. "Yeah, Jackson," I admitted. "What did you come to New York for?" "For good." I was joking, not indignant. "No. I mean, did your mother have a job opportunity here?" "She knew she could get a job," I said. "She's got her master's." The conversation went on with small talk like that. "And you think you might like Fieldston?" "I don't know if I'd like it. I understand it's a good school." "It's a very good school, with smaller classes and more intensive study, and better college opportunities come from that," he said. "But you'd have to take an examination." I decided he could probably take, or at least understand, a joke. "A physical? I could pass that." I had reached the end of my strawberry sundae. So it was arranged. Sort of. The procedure, whatever it was, that would gain me admission to the Riverdale equivalent of Valhalla would be handled by Professor Heller. I understood this to be a unique benefit, a lock, a guarantee, or as close to fact as yesterday's New York Times, like having a high wire act done for you by Joseph Walinda, like getting the amazing Kreskin to pick your daily number. The only thing remaining was the mere formality of the admissions test. It was rarely an obstacle, I was told. It was more used like an aptitude test to gauge what courses I needed to work on. So I went back to completing the year at a school I was now certain I could get out of, DeWitt Clinton, to working on my basketball game at whatever local gym was open at night, and to picking up whatever work I could on Fordham Road. Just before the exam, though, I took a sort of field trip to Fieldston to visit the place and audit a couple of classes. I really hated it. You needed to be rich just to drive past their campus, which resembled a New England college with all the buildings handsomely connected by hallways and gray stones encircling well-tended lawns. There was enough ivy on the walls to redo the outfield at Wrigley Field. So when it came time for the test, I took a dive through it. The room where I took the test was like a college lecture hall. It was a hall full, probably 75 people. They might not have all been trying to get in for free like I was. Miss Leaf had said the tuition was about $2,200 a year, and it seemed unlikely they were all trying to get into the 11th grade. I doubted there would be more than a dozen openings in a Fieldston class in 5 years, unless a bomb was dropped on Wall Street. I spent the full 3 hours on the English section, but once the math section started, I gave straight answers on 35 or 40 questions and left after about an hour. 2 weeks later, the phone rang out at our apartment. It was Professor Heller. I hadn't been expecting a call. Figured they'd send a letter, but maybe it was good that the professor called. I owed him an apology or a thank you. It needed to be something like, "Thank you for the chance I kicked away, sir." Saying that I could have done better on the test wouldn't sound any more convincing to the professor than it sounded rattling around inside my head, and I knew it was true. But if I couldn't convince myself, somewhat disappointing test results, he was saying. That was a slick way of putting it. I can't say I didn't know how much my mother wanted me to go to Fieldston. I can say that as I listened to Professor Heller, I thought I knew how much she wanted it. I didn't know again. And the committee was not enthusiastic about it, but if you're willing to meet, I need to ask you again, however, if you really want to come here, Gil, because if you don't, then we're wasting our time. Yes, sir, I'm interested. He said he would try to arrange a meeting with the committee. This was starting to sound like extra things I didn't want to do. But that was the whole point. To go somewhere with your hat in your hand is to go through things you don't want. If you want the scholarship, you have to reveal this and reveal that, test for this and test for that. Man, there was a lot of shit to go through. And now, some kind of committee. But hadn't I stood in line after crowded line to sign up for classes at Clinton and stood around registering for the wrong fucking classes at Creston? Waited 150 or 200 years to get into Tigret back in Jackson? At least what I was going through now was supposed to be for something valuable. The meeting was set up, and then one morning a week, a later or so, I heard 4 sharp raps on my door. Bam, 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 bam. That was not the way I was used to getting up. I rolled over groggily onto the book I'd been reading the previous night, and my bare feet hit the floor. Not quick enough. Bam, 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 bam. It was my uncle. Scotty, it's 8 o'clock. I opened the door. My uncle was moving towards my mother's room. Get yourself some juice, he said, and go to your thing. I went into her room and closed the door behind him. I knew my face looked like a question mark as I washed up. I could hear my mother through both doors moaning and saying things with a thick voice I did not recognize. Tell Scotty, go ahead to the meeting, okay? What was wrong? What was going on? Uncle Bebe came out of her room and again closed the door. a tense, uncomfortable expression on his face. "Go on and get dressed and go to your meeting," he said with serious eyes. "She'll be all right. Get moving now. You don't need to be late for this. She's going to the hospital where Sammy was. Call when you get a minute." Then he was back in my mother's room, and I was adjusting my jacket collar and quick stepping down the stairs. I could hear my mother slurring loudly to tell me to go to the meeting, and Bibi saying, "Okay, okay." I heard the doorbell buzz and click open as I reached the first floor, and I recognized my mother's harried, hurried, horrid doctor as he came in with his shirt sleeves rolled halfway up, his wrinkled striped tie hanging limp and off-center, and his forehead sweating. And that will conclude this week's segment. We will pick up there next Friday, session number 3, Gil Scott Heron, The Last Holiday. We'll be picking back up in chapter 12. Folks have commentary that they would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Folks who are with us, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. Line should be open. Retired firefighter Mr. Demery Ford, your line should be open. I'll look out for other hands if other folks have commentary that they would like to share as well.
I'll go ahead and tell my notes if I can. Can I be heard?
Waiting on you, sir.
Oh, okay. Okay. First thing I got down here is the understanding of the name Jackson. And it's quite common surname of a lot of non-white black people also, as he mentioned. And what sticks in my mind is the racist former president Andrew Jackson, slave owner also. He was kind of like the Cecil Rhodes of the Northwestern Hemisphere. He was such a treacherous individual, especially down here, which he was a primary catalyst in what we know today as the Trail of Tears, the longest war that took place by what is called the United States. It was actually against indigenous peoples, and he was a significant figure in it. Andrew Jackson was. Number two, Chuck Taylors. He really conjured up some memories with the Chuck Taylors. They only cost $10 during my time as a teenager, and they were called cons. Very popular sneakers. You had to have a pair. I put it that way. You know, you took out the shoestrings and put in some colored shoestrings of whatever color that you wanted. Primarily, would be the high school you went to. He mentioned about washing dishes. Back in my day, it was called bussing suds. It was a job, but a typical job that non-white black males had as teenagers. I myself was making the fantastic amount of money, $1.80 an hour. Bussing suds in a restaurant, excuse me, in a restaurant myself.
In this case, it was the old-fashioned way, right there in the sink with dishes. And there was a dishwasher, but we weren't allowed to use it. 5 hours was standard employment time for teens. I think back during that time, he mentioned about 5 hours during his time, and it was a standard hours of employment for teenagers during my time as a teenager also. I have down here, I had similar experiences in high school. He mentioned about his high school had 3 shifts, and my high school was so overcrowded, we had 2 shifts. The first shift was for 11th and 12th graders. It started 7:25 in the morning, and school was out at 12:30 p.m. And the second shift, which was of 10th graders, was from 12:35 to 5:30 for 10th graders. Moving on, the sixth thing I wrote down here, just about every time he mentions about his mom's, it convincing me that she was very codified of the things that she had to say and share with him. And I think it probably played a very instrumental part of his childhood, especially, you know, at the time when they became connected with one another. It seemed as though everything that she was saying is very constructive. Number seven, everybody knows where they were at and what they were doing on 11/22/63 and 4/4/68. With myself, although I was very little on 11/22/63, I was in the first grade. I do recall I was able to walk home from school by myself, because the school wasn't very far from our place of residence. And I remember my mother standing in front of a television set watching the same thing he was talking about, which was the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Fifth grade, we were about to eat dinner, where the televised report interrupted regular TV to mention about the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Number eight, also just more on the same thing that he mentioned about that it's not important. It's not important. I'm gonna skip that one. Number nine, I find it ironic that a white teacher, I had down here discovered, and that's an incorrect word. It's one of those words that I would figure is in the word guide to not to use or use with caution. And I put down recognized instead of discovered his talent of being able to write that sort of thing. And this is where we're at now with the idea of this quote-unquote specialized school. And that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Mr. Demery Ford, do you have any commentary? Might not be in an area where he can speak.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Okay. As the reading was going on, the stuff was standing out to me was, like the firefighter pointed out, the overcrowdedness in the school that he was in before, all those students and having to take shifts, that's hard to imagine. But I guess that's common when you're in a system like we in, and we're coming up in last place on in every area. Education is just one the areas in which, you know, racism is practiced. And when he talked about Miss Nettie, I guess she was the white English teacher that was responsible for trying to recruit him to a better school. I guess she had seen his writings and saw some type of potential there. But like you say, white people are not ignorant about these things. They, she could see the promise in that and probably could see a lot more. The guy is writing at a certain level, but his interest and his enthusiasm was probably suffering because of the situation, the environment that he was in. So, like always, like all of them that, you know, see some type of promise and maybe some money, you know, they take you out for dinner or get you something to eat to start to disarm you. And at that time, mostly what he was thinking about is just the fact of, you know, talking to girls, or if there was going to be any girls at that particular school. And I thought it was interesting that he decided not to ask them if there were any black people at the school. You know, I guess he was not wanting to blow his chance to go to another school. It's just funny how the responses that, you know, we give to racism. But he went into detail describing about the assassination of JFK. And then, you know, that brings to mind on the recent shooting of the congressman at a baseball game. You see pictures, you get a report that does not necessarily have to be true. And the same way this happened, the shooter or the so-called accused shooter doesn't seem to live, so you can't get the full story out of them. And it's 25, in this case, 50, 60 years later, you still don't know the truth of what really happened. So I thought it was also interesting that he had made this point in his education, and he said that aside from Langston Hughes' column in the Chicago Defender, he wasn't familiar with a lot of black literature. And before that, he had said that the separate piece book that was required reading in his English class was the point to where his communication with Miss Lee turned static, because you know, I can remember, I guess I'm old enough, if I can remember that book being required reading and thinking the same thing, but you can't look at it like trying to relate yourself. It's required, you got to get through this course, so you just bear through it and try to understand some aspects of it. And he was suspicious about the white people trying to help him out, and that's healthy. We should all have a healthy suspicion. Well, the way he phrased it, he thought that maybe she had committed some type of felony and she was paying penance. Maybe she had to recruit someone as part of her penalty. But I didn't see her as a top recruiter any more than I saw Clinton as a prime recruiting territory, and any more than I saw myself as a good recruit. I was a long shot. How long? How about the odds against a jackass in the Kentucky Derby? You know, to describe himself like that, you know, at least brings attention to the fact that he didn't have a lot of hope or faith in, you know, a bright future. But I'll mute my line on that, give somebody else a chance. Thanks.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery, for our lovely black mom in Michigan. Nice to hear from her today, especially because she's been one of our narrators previously for Leonita McLean, also a biography, Leonita McLean, A Foot in Each World, kind of sort of, it's just her columns, but same thing. She did some of the narration for that, so she can attest to the labor one has to invest to do the narration for the audio clips. Did you have commentary you wanted to share? You should be with us as well, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to the callers and listeners. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Perfect. I just wanted to say that I'm excited about reading this book. I just got my copy, and I ordered two copies. I didn't realize I had ordered two copies when I purchased the book, so I wanted to offer the book to one of the Kyle's listeners who may not have the actual book. Gus, if you could, you know, if someone is interested, maybe they can email you and you can give them my email address and I will ship a copy of the book to anyone who wants my extra copy. And great. Again, I'm looking forward to this book.
Awesome. That's great. So any listeners, if you want a hard copy of The Last Holiday, can be autographed, Black Mom in Detroit. She said she is willing to donate. I guess if you email me, and then I'll just the first person to email Gus that they would like the book, I guess maybe a mailing address, and maybe that can help facilitate it. Yeah, and I can email her to see if there's anything else. But just drop me an email, Last Holiday Book, and we will get it cracking. Let's see. For other folks, if you all have commentary that you would like to share, go ahead and get your hand up. We have about 20 minutes left in the broadcast. I have a few notes as well, but do not wait till the last minute. Go ahead and speak now, or at least get your hand up if you think you have something you want to share. Some of the things that stood out from the second audio segment, let's see, when he talked about the Kennedy assassination, that obviously took up a lot of time in Coretta Scott King's memoir that we just finished up, a huge act, you know, as retired firefighters said. In fact, I remembered Mr. Fuller, he said that on the time that he's been on planet Earth, and he lived through World War II, he lived through 9/11, and lived through 9/11 in Washington, D.C., no less. He said that living through all of that, by far, no event traumatized people in a more intense manner than the assassination of JFK. He said it was absolutely stunning. Just people were not expecting it. Just it was everyone was just totally stunned that could have happened at that time, regardless of what they think about what happened about it, that it was stunning. And he said it didn't compare to anything, any of the major events that he's seen in his life on the planet. And he also continued exactly where he was at the time of the shooting. But said he wrote a letter to the Washington Post, no less, about the shooting that they did not publish, where he gave his views about the assassination and racism, which is classic Fuller. But yeah, that JFK assassination traumatized me, and I was not even born at the time that it happened. I think it traumatized a lot of people, but it did help to get me on the road of studying and learning about, thinking seriously about racism, white supremacy as a major problem. And in fact, it traumatized me so much, I've talked to a number of people about this event over the years. Dr. Cambon, for folks who know, that is an area that I study. Directly related to that assassination, the film Executive Action, which I've sound clipped on this film before, it directly ties that assassination to racism, white supremacy, and having a white U.S. president who is not doing things that are in the best interest for the global system of racism. So we will have to replace him with someone who, and I mean, saying this explicitly in the movie, Executive Action, he is explicitly doing things that are going to mess it up, mess our control up, of the black people and other non-white populations abroad. Like, he's doing things specifically that are going to disrupt our ability to maintain power over those people. That's stated in the film. Executive Action, courtesy of Kamau Kanban. Downloaded that one. That is a classic. Continuing where all of this is from chapter 12, all of the notes I'm reading right now, where he says, he's talking about the teacher, Mrs. Nettie, I guess it was Nettie Leaf, excuse me, his English teacher. And he said she did not look like someone who had been destined to pull faculty duty at an institution for 8,000 mostly black and Latin boys at a school that looked more like a penitentiary than a school. Not by accident. We've talked about architecture on the compensatory call-in recently. Not by accident, where you design an environment that's supposed to be for learning and stimulating young, growing minds to think and imagine and explore and be curious. New. We want them thinking that they're in some dungeon where they're going to be locked down and under surveillance. I mean, that is, wow. Continuing, no accident. And again, this is what we want to be integrated into, quote unquote. Continuing, he says, I thought the lottery was justice. When he talked about a separate piece, I was forced to read a separate piece. And all of this stuff here, I can completely relate, and I think tons, legions of black people can relate to having this sort of nonsense where you're just reading exactly what he calls it, a book that was white noise about white people. It's not teaching you any lessons other than white supremacy and just glorifying the culture of white supremacy. Then I can totally understand why tons of non-white people become bored with school or disinterested, drop out, all of that, and certainly do not enjoy reading because you're not reading Gil Scott Heron. You're not reading Assata Shakur. You're reading a separate piece. Continuing. Let's see. Oh, my. When he says, when he's having his meeting, he's trying to figure out whether he's going to go to Fieldston. He makes a joke. He said, you had to be very careful about joking with white folks. One of his first, really definitive statements talking explicitly about white people, not saying they like he did last chapter with the school integration bit. Continuing, you had to be very careful about joking with white folks. They took everything, especially themselves, very seriously. And at the same time, they resented a brother taking himself that same way. Or a sister. Very important, and I would say that that is accurate. Absolutely, and I do not even encourage doing a whole lot of joking around with white people. Take them very seriously. But yeah, I have seen where, joking around with white people can go very bad. That's why it's something that I do not encourage. When he talks about this second exchange, very different the way that this second exchange, if you contrast to when he had the conversation after his mother went to speak to the previously unidentified white educator. And now we get names for these people, Professor Heller and Nettie Leaf. We get all these folks' names. They are distinct, and he gives, more characteristics about them and who they are. When he talks about Professor Heller, he says Professor Heller asked questions. He was a nice, soft-spoken gentleman who made me feel a little ashamed of my suspicions. This tells me this is a very effective, refined race soldier. Why do I say that? When you have a white person who can encounter a black person who is appropriately suspicious, and they can make that victim of racism feel bad about using logic to correctly identify an enemy, that is an especially dangerous, an especially effective race soldier, in my opinion. Jeffrey Dahmer, he could go out and talk, went out and talked to the police officers and got them to help him walk one of his victims back in the house. Especially dangerous, especially effective when they can get you to not be suspicious even when you should be, when it's logical for you to be suspicious, they can get you to drop your guard. Very, very effective. I thought that was an important portion. A lot of times they can do it with offers. You know, hey, let's go get an ice cream. Let's see if we can bring you to this school. They got tons of resources. We stole and looted and raped the entire planet. We got all kinds of goodies that we can offer you. Continuing. I try to pay attention to metaphors. I don't always call them out, but a couple pages later when he says, he's talking to, still about Professor Heller and everything. He says, I understood this to be a unique benefit, a lock, a guarantee, because he had made this connection with Professor Heller, this well-spoken, soft-spoken white man. I understood it to be a benefit, a lock, a guarantee, or as close to fact as yesterday's New York Times, that publication is the source of fact, is, you know, a lock of truth, of something that is definitive beyond dispute. It's the New York Times, particularly when we keep in mind John Pataj said that one of the more effective ways that COINTELPRO was waged in smearing people, probably like Gil Scott-Heron, I'm sure he has a COINTELPRO file, was using publications like the New York Times to get either people that were on their staff, the FBI, whoever, whatever, white supremacy enforcement agency, getting people to either write stories, ghostwrite stories, and have it published in the New York Times, or you have someone on your staff who also works at the New York Times, or you have someone there that is friendly to you that you can just pass information along and get it in their stories and what have you. Just thought that was noteworthy. Let's see. Anything else? When he said the tuition for Fieldston was $2,200 per year, I did the math on that for 2017. That would be right at about $18,000 a year if we were going to do this is 1963. They're saying that the tuition was $2,200 a year. So with inflation and everything, that would be about right at $18,000. So this is a pretty pricey institution. We had a listener who wrote in commentary. She said the thing that stood out, this is one of our listeners in Wisconsin, by the way. She said the thing that stood out the most was when Gil killed the snake in his grandmother's garden. Without hesitation, he killed the snake because he was not in the mood to figure out whether or not the snake was poisonous. He just knew that it was a possibility. This is how I think he was a black, wait a minute, this is how I think that we as black people should view whites. We have no time, and there should never be a mood that causes us to try and figure out who is a good white person. There is no such thing. What also stood out was his eye-opening experience of having his cat poisoned. Him realizing that some death is caused is like our experiences as black people being more confused about racism, white supremacy, and then getting a rude awakening to the real terrors that show us what it really means to be white. Muhammad Ali gave an example of having 10,000 snakes coming through a door at him, and 1,000 of the snakes were not harmful. He said it made sense for him to close the door on all the snakes because he had no time to figure out which of the snakes would not harm him. And lastly, his grandmother passing is recorded on one of his songs. I heard the song many times before, but while reading the book, I mourned with him, remembering the song. Thanks for reading my comments. For sure, we'll have to get, he has such a massive song library. That's, you know, that can be your homework for this book. If anybody wants to do additional research, you know, go, you could probably go to your library. You could probably just go on YouTube. And I think it would probably be best for full context to maybe listen to complete albums, because they have some of his live performances. He did some live studio albums, live recordings, where you can listen to a complete album, a complete recording, and that way you can hear all the songs and the order that he had them arranged and everything, and really appreciate the artistry of Gil Scott-Heron. That would be my recommendation. But yeah, I'll see if I can locate that song specifically about his grandmother and include that one as well. The caller at let's see, last four digits 3637, did you have commentary? 3637, you should be with us.
Hello, everyone. This is caller from 712. I just stepped away from my working for a minute, and I wanted to comment. I'm thankful that we're reading this book, and what stood out to me in this reading was the fact that they were talking about the literature that they had to read in school. They're still doing that. My son just finished the 10th grade, and he's in high school, and he did have to read that Shirley Jackson, The Lottery. I promised him I was going to read it just to see what they were reading and what that was all about. He kind of broke it down to me, but, I mean, I am a person that wasn't a big reader, and I think a large part of that was what we had to read in school. Like, we had to read things like The Grapes of Wrath and Les Miserables and things that just weren't interesting, and it just kind of turned me off from reading. But now that I'm an older person, I'm really discovering, like, I just discovered Zora Neale Hurston, and I read her, one of her books, beautiful book. I read Invisible Man, because I hear you always speaking of Invisible Man, another just stunning book that should be, you know, studied in high school literature, but a lot of those books are not. And I would like to get that copy that the mom in Michigan was given away. But Gus, every time I email you, I don't think you're getting my emails, because I emailed you, I've been trying to email you for the past 3 months about this this racist suspect, getting him on the couch as a guest, but I don't think you're getting my emails, so I'm going to try to email you again, and I'm coming from a Gmail account, so hopefully you'll get it. And that was my contribution. Great, great book so far. And I'm really thankful that I discovered the cows, because I'm really getting caught up on my reading that I probably should have been reading when I was in junior high and high school. I'm getting caught up on it now. So thanks for letting me speak.
Indeed. I guess there you go. I think that would be the first person to respond for the book. I don't know what the email issue is. I reckon, I'm looking at my email now, so if you send it now, I guess I'm looking right at it, so I'll know it's you. And if it continues to be a problem, I guess if you use Twitter at Until Justice, you can direct message me on Twitter. If you're on Facebook, you can Facebook message me as well, if you use Facebook. We'll see if one of the three doesn't solve the problem. But yeah, I thought important observations from the book as well. Reading, very important. And same thing, that's why I said I think a lot of black people get turned off from reading. Exactly as you said, we're not reading this sort of stuff. Even though I did Zora Neale Hurston, I did read that when I was in school. I did get that assignment. But most of the quality reading that I did was stuff that I got after school. Things that, you know, Invisible Man, after school. Things like Medical Apartheid, after school. Anywho, unless folks had anything else that they wanted to get in, any final comments?
Yes, I was just sitting here laughing because of with the talk about snakes. I use an analogy. There was this white male down here in South Florida by the name of Bill Hast, who was an expert on snakes. He had this institution not too far from where I grew up that was called the Serpentarium. And he was worldwide. He had been bitten by so many poisonous snakes that his blood actually can be used as a serum. He actually looked like a snake also, in a sense. But anyway, he would go to the public schools, because during that time, a lot of children apparently were getting bitten by snakes, poison snakes. And his warning was to, you're not a snake expert, so treat every snake like it's poisonous. And you can use that same analogy with white people. The exact same analogy you can use. We're not experts on racism, white supremacy. So therefore, every white person can be suspected as being a racist. You know, and I use that in analogies when I'm sharing and exchanging views with other people. So just thought it was kind of ironic that it was mentioned by one of the call-in writers. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think Minister Malcolm has a pretty infamous line where he uses that same analogy in talking about snakes, and not going to spend a whole lot of time trying to figure out which one is poisonous and which one is not. Same way for, and really with white people, I mean, hey, perhaps all of them are poisonous. Maybe that is what it is. Maybe that's what it means to be white. Anything else? Folks satisfied? We will assume everybody is good. We will be here again next Friday, session number 3. We are flying through this book. We are roughly a little less than a third of the way through the books. We're making great time, and yeah, we'll be looking forward. Hopefully we'll have good participation as we proceed through the book. You can always email in if you listen to the archives and have thoughts you want to share. With that, so we'll be here tomorrow, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here on Sunday, that would be June 18th, early program, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, the Grenfell Tower fire in London that impacted a lot of black people, folks with melanin. We'll be talking about that. We obviously have a lot of black British listeners, and they have been talking about that and specifically pointing out, I mean, this is standard operating procedure. You put black people in a residential area where it has terrible fire code. We have a retired firefighter here where it has a terrible fire code, where the residents have been saying that this is a catastrophe waiting to happen. And then it does happen. And a dozen people or more end up being killed, and without a home. I mean, total tragedy and act of white supremacy. We'll be talking about that on Sunday, in addition to the election. On Monday, Esther Stanford Cosse will be back with us. She's been with us repeatedly, black female. She's also in London. She was just on the BBC's broadcast where they had the segment on can white people be victims of racism? And she did a brilliant job responding and just breaking down the folly and deception in such a premise. And then also she'll have quite a bit to say about the fire as well. But that'll also be an early broadcast. That will also be 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. So both the Sunday Global Sunday Talk on Racism and then the broadcast on Monday with Esther Stanford Cosse. Both of those two programs will be early, obviously, because they've got, you know, folks in different parts of the world. So they'll be 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, and 12 noon Pacific. That is Sunday and Monday that we'll be broadcasting with our international subject matter, all still related racism, white supremacy, locally, nationally, globally. If you have any questions, can't find something in the archives, have a guest recommendation, if you're having trouble sending an email, just untiljustice@gmail.com. You can also try us on Twitter at Until Justice, Facebook as well. I'm sure we'll figure out some way of making communication. Thanks for everyone tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. I will say again, enjoy the summer. Great, warm weather, outstanding. All that vitamin D you can. Just stay codified. Sobriety would be best even when the weather is beautiful. Racists do not pause from abusing black people just because the sun is shining. Let's make sure we remain in counter-racist mode. If you got to consume alcohol or whatever it is, go to your residence, get to one spot and stay there. That way you don't run the risk of running into a race soldier badge or no. It already war is being waged against us. You do not want to make it easier for them to terrorize and abuse us where you cannot think clearly and make quality decisions because you're intoxicated, not being a serious counter-racist soldier. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.